session number 12927, wheel 2.
Mrs. Woodruff, reel 2.
So I said to the old woman, well, had we better throw the letters away, which we did to her intense relief. And she went on searching me, and she found my rosary, so she thought I must be all right, and that my name was Maria Immaculada, which they thought was a very reassuring name on that side of Spain. Well, then we got to the border, and Douglas and this Spanish man were given back their passports, and I wasn't given mine. And I said, what's happened to my passport? It was in the same order as his. Why can't I have it? And we waited quite a time, and then one of these huge men with blue chins and a gun came and bowed low and gave me back my passport. And what had happened was that they had a bet at the frontier post, the guards, as to whether a woman's maiden name appeared on an English passport. And very few English women had passed that way. So when my passport came, it had to be passed round everywhere, including the night shift, who had to be woken up to look at my passport before I could have it back. Which is quite funny, really.
Where did you then go?
We went first to St. Sebastian and stayed in the Maria Cristina, the sort of posh hotel there. And the funny man called Rosales, who drove us, was a tobacco millionaire from Barcelona. And he was to take us. I forget what happened about that. Because I know Douglas and I were in a bus going, I think, to Burgos. And there was a man in uniform with a red beret. Well, the red berets were the Recotes, were the Carlists, who were really very anti-Franco in a way, but they thought they had a way of getting their own back. And while we were sitting in this bus, not talking, he suddenly bent forward and in the best English said, have you seen, and he mentioned some friend of ours in England. And I don't know whether he'd been put on to tail us, but he stayed with us and was very amusing. And, you know, he's really good company when we went everywhere with him. We went to Burgos and we saw this British agent there. I can't remember his name. So somebody something. And he told us a good deal about what was going on. And where did we go from there? Our first journeys. We went to Guernica.
What did you see there?
Well, a certain amount of destruction. And the people who took us explained that the Germans had bombed it. And the Reds explained that the fascists had destroyed it. And there was this famous picture, and all the others believed that. I don't know. Later I got used to knowing what places looked like bombed by the Germans. But at that time at Guernica I had no idea. So I still don't know who was telling the truth. And they said it had all been evacuated and that there had been very few casualties. And the other said there had been enormous casualties. So that's how things are in war.
So it was difficult to find the truth?
Yes.
What type of things that you saw there helped to make up your mind about the situation?
Well, you see, all the rumours one got about was what the Reds were doing and their atrocities and killing the priests and nuns everywhere in the most dreadful way. And so we thought we were on the side of the right side and a crusade in a way for a long time. It became less like a crusade, I think, as time wore on. I remember Evelyn Waugh saying, I don't think we'll think it's a crusade much longer.
But did you visit priests and seminaries? And
yes, we visited the English seminary at Valladolid, which had been there for many years. I don't think we visited many Italian ones, I mean Spanish ones.
What type of things did the priests and so on tell you?
Well, I think they'd been well treated all along. They'd got on with the people, and I did help them as best they could. There was no hostility there. I think the Spaniards thought we were all awful in England because it was so strong. All these people going into the International Brigade, and the Duchess of Athol, and all these young poets who went and got themselves killed. It was a very extraordinary situation. There was just this great sense of division. One couldn't see how it, without a victory, how it could ever remedy itself as a nation. But we weren't there very long, and we were there very much towards the end. And by the time we got back, which I think was the summer of 38, that poor man, the Prime Minister, had gone to Germany and came back saying, peace in our time, having seen Hitler and believing his word, you remember?
Yes.
Well, when that started, you didn't think of anything else at the time. And in no time, people were beginning to practice. You know, well, I had to teach young women how to do bandaging and join the Free French Ambulance Forces and things of that sort. And I taught a bit.
You were telling me earlier that in Spain, you were telling me this off the record, that you wanted to see some Italians in hospital.
Oh, yes. I went to the military hospital and said, I can't talk Spanish, but I can talk Italian. If you have any Italian wounded, could I see them? But they somehow or other very clever prevented me from seeing them. I've forgotten how, but I know I didn't see them. They obviously thought they were a miserable lot and despised them.
You said that you visited San Sebastian and Guernica.
Yes.
And Valladolid.
Yes.
Which other places did you go to?
Vitoria. I don't remember much about that. And then the Pamplona on the way back. And that's really where the Carlists had all their headquarters. And that was very interesting. We went one evening to a club full of these old... It was like in Scotland and the heads of clans, you know, grand old men sitting round. And I smoked. I did in those days. And one of these old men came up and complained. Their women did not smoke. So I had to stop. And they were very noble, those old boys. They were very attractive. We were there a few days and liked it better than anywhere else. But in the hotel bedroom, there were sort of toenails on the floor next to my bed where there'd been Germans the day before. So I didn't like that much.
Was there any element on the Franco side which you particularly favoured yourself? Was that the racketeers?
The racketeers were much nicer than the other people, the Jose Antonio's men. We were, yes, of course, we did go sometime to the place that, you know, Serrano Sunia, the brother-in-law of Franco,
yes,
came from, there was a place, and we were there several days. And
Galicia?
No, oh no, not as far as that, no.
Asturias?
No, down in the... No, that was all red. A big town, big industrial town. We were there for several days, and that's where we saw a lot of the regular Spanish fighters.
Not Bilbao?
Absolutely.
Any other memories you've got of the Spanish Civil War?
I don't seem to have an awful lot, except people would come and tell one of atrocities. But we came back, you see, and just then Neville Chamberlain came back with his Peace in Our Time and all that. So people began digging trenches in London straight away, and my Red Cross, I was sort of called up and worked in, helped to instruct. And then when the bombing began, I was working in the Westminster Hospital, and we used to see the dogfights overhead on these beautiful days in the summer of 1940. And then I used to spend as much time as I could there, and then divide the rest, go back to the Italians the rest of the time. So I was kept pretty busy. But then in September, they said, would I go down to the East End? Because they wanted some help there. So I went down in the underground and came out at Aldgate East. And there was a German machine gunning the street. I don't think he did much harm. But I went to the Bernard Baron settlement there, where a lot of frightened women had come in. And Sir Bernard Henriquez, who was a lovely man who ran it, had said to me, well, you see, you're there to reassure them, so you can't go home tonight. You've got to stay. So he took me into the shelter, where 18,000 people sheltered every night. It was a huge, it wasn't underground, but it was a huge, very safe building, which used to be known as the Tilbury, because apparently there'd been a sort of Tilbury and Chatham railway at one time there. And it was also really where people stored things. Sainsbury kept their butter there, which I thought so awful because of these people who weren't very clean and couldn't help it, sleeping on the next to the boxes, you know. I stayed there that night, and it was the Jewish New Year, and a lot of old gentlemen in bowler hats came and wished me a Happy New Year. And after that, I installed myself practically 5 nights a week, looking after them during the night. The local, not the hospitals, but the public health people, all rather packed up. And the doctor, who was the minister, the chief health man there, came and said, we're leaving 100 people for you to look after tonight, and we're evacuating them tomorrow. So I had all these people lying on the floor in the shelter on stretchers, knowing nothing about them, and they being abandoned by the local authority to our tender care. I always had a young girl working with me and getting her used to the business. But the night that the city of London burned, I was driving down, it was a Sunday night, and when I got to St. Paul's, by that time, Molotov cocktails were falling all over the place, and the hydrants were there, and there were no people, of course, because it was Sunday night in the city, and the place where I worked was beyond all that. And just as I got out of the car, there was a huge crash, and something that used to be called a landmine came down. And in my place, all the lights were out, and all the medicines and things were chucked on the floor. And the people were rather frightened. And then there were great bangs, because there were 9 lifts, lift shafts in this great building, which were hydraulic. And so when the bombing started, the lifts all began crashing down, and water poured all over the place. And outside my little dispensary was a huge pool, and it was just like Alice in Wonderland, I thought. I also thought I was going to die, but I had to go around and see what was happening. And miraculously, no one was seriously hurt. But then I had to evacuate about 2,000 people into another bit that hadn't been damaged, and there was no light. I stood in the doorway with a hurricane lantern, and these people went through. And you know, in my Red Cross uniform, you have a huge Red Cross on your bosom. And these old Jews would come and say, it is good for us that you wear that, which I thought very touching. We became very fast friends.
What exactly did they mean by that?
Well, I suppose they thought the cross was a sign of saving, but I didn't think the Jews did think that. But they attributed it to the Red Cross, I suppose, as a marvelous institution. And when it was Christmas, and I had a little crib in my place, they used to come and look at it and say, and I'd say, that's the Messiah. And they said, oh, if we could only believe that. I made great friends with the Jews in the East End for years.
What was public spirit like under the impact of the bombing?
Well, of course, the young men were terrified of being called up because they were terrified of being made prisoner. So they were all in the fire service and that sort of thing, and I, which was fine. There was hating and cursing Hitler and saying how awful it was. And you see, every night for months, well, practically from September till almost for a year, there was bombing almost every night. You know, there wasn't actually at Christmas. But, and then you see, a lot of them were old and couldn't speak English. They were old refugees from some time past who'd lived in the East End. And I could understand them through knowing German, but they couldn't understand my German. So it was very, I had to have interpreters if there was anything serious the matter with them. And we had doctors that visited. Sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't. And then we had we were very near the docks. And so there were very often dock fights that came my way. They always used to say, a bit of shrapnel, nurse. And in fact, it was a razor blade, you know, in the other man's hand, nicking as near the eye as they could. One man was scalped, and I had to sew his scalp, his hair on again. It came right off at the back, and I pushed it back on, and we stitched it up. It was very enjoyable. I loved every minute of it.
So these were gangland fights?
Oh, well, yes, small ones.
Did anybody think that Hitler was going to win?
No. I don't think anyone did. It wasn't in the British character to think it could happen.
People sometimes say that we were all one then, that there was a sense of unity amongst rich and poor.
Oh, there was up to a point, but I was with the poor in these shelters, sleeping on boards and, you know, and among all the stored goods and things, whereas the others were in the basement of the Grosvenor House. You know, it's a very different place to take shelter in from the East End shelters. But I got a lot of people came down to visit my place. It got quite well known. Some of these American journalists came to visit and write it up, and various politicians, and it had quite a reputation. And the officials, the shelter marshals, or whatever they were called, the civil defense men, were very, very good. And one of them, called Garman, who was the chief one in this shelter, he and I were great friends. And years, years later, I don't know how many years later, perhaps almost 20, I was in Commercial Road catching a bus because I'd been to the law courts there with a friend of mine who was the magistrate. And I noticed that the haberdasher shop opposite me was called Garman on the blind. And I thought, oh yes, that was the name of that nice man in the shelter. Suddenly two people rushed across the road, and they were the Garmans who'd recognized me and remembered our having been so happy together in those strange days.
Who else was working with you at that time?
Well, the Red Cross, and I was in charge of the medical aid in the place, and I was the commandant for Stepney for the Red Cross. And I generally had one girl who'd come down with me, a new recruit, but sometimes I had a more experienced one. But there were one or two women among the shelterers who were quite useful and did a good job, and anyway brought anyone to me who needed looking after. And I had a doctor in most evenings of one or another and would keep the patients for them. One night, it was quite funny, three very grand doctors from the Ministry of Health turned up. And they said, "We've come to see how you're doing here. Will you show us what you do?" So I showed them my medicine cupboard. And at that moment, the door opened, and in came a man, absolutely rigid. And I had a little sort of camp bed there. So I put him on the camp bed, and he was stiff as a poker. So I turned to these grand doctors and said, "Will you examine the patient?" And they did one after the other and said, "What is it? I don't know." They said, "Do you know?" I said, "Oh, yes, I know. It's meth poisoning." Well, they'd never seen meth poisoning before. And so I said, "What shall I do?" And they said, "We don't know. What do you do?" And I said, "I do this." And I put some ammonia on some cotton wool and shoved it up his nostrils. And he sat up and said, "Sorry, nurse, I'm drunk." Put some coppers in my Red Cross box and staggered out into the night. Another time, a man came in with a head injury. He'd been out in a raid and got hit. And I said he had to wait till the doctor came because you shouldn't let head people loose. And that very good man who looked after my henchman there, my man Friday, called Barney. Barney came and said, "He doesn't want you to keep him because he was on his way to rob a bank." We had a lot of lovely people like that in the shelter. But I was very fond of them, and they were fond of me, and it was very interesting. Then as things went on, people would come down, you know, concert parties and that sort of thing, or different forms of religion would come and have religious services there.
So a commandant in the Red Cross is a bit like a matron.
It's like a... Well, the commandant really runs the recruiting side and the administration. But I was a nursing VAD, so I did the medical stuff there. Oh, it was so interesting.
Now, you were telling me earlier that although you were only a child in the First World War, that you can actually... you've got some clear memories of it.
Oh, yes. My father was a diplomat. And he was chargé d'affaires at Darmstadt and Hesse, because in those days all these little German principalities had diplomatic representation on their own, although they were federated with the German Empire. And we lived at Darmstadt, but he was a lord-in-waiting. And he happened to be in waiting with the king at Windsor when the war broke out. And my brother and sister and I were with our grandmother in Bavaria, where they had a lovely villa. And my mother, with my three younger siblings, and her mother, and Nanny, and a maid, were in Baden-Baden doing a cure. And my father, the king said to my father, "Don't bother about me, go and deal with your family." So it must have been about the 2nd of August. And he got as far as Switzerland, and on the 4th, of course, war was declared, so he couldn't get into Germany. So we were there till the middle of October. It wasn't too bad. We had to put out a flag when they said they had a victory. And, of course, one never knew what was true. And, of course, there was no radio or anything like that in those days, so it was mostly rumours. But my grandmother was half German, and Lady Acton, the wife of the historian, my grandfather, and she was known there. They went on pretty very nasty to us. I remember one day we were crossing the lake in a boat, and the young men began sort of trying to pretend they were going to drown us, but they didn't. And then in the end we got out and spent the rest of the war in Switzerland, where he was being a diplomat at the British legation, as it then was. I was 9 years old, so I don't take a very active part in it all. But there was a time when the sick prisoners of war, there was an arrangement with the Swiss that they should be allowed out to various places under guard to convalesce on both sides. And ours came to Châteaudet and Meuron. So whenever we had an illness or anything like that, all we asked was to go and spend the holidays in one of those places so as to be with the boys, which was a big thrill. Because when you're out of your own country in wartime, you become terribly patriotic. And our minister, as he then was, Sir Horace Rumbold, had a son called Tony, who was quite a well-known diplomat himself later. He's no longer alive. And when we used to go and toboggan on a certain hill near where we all lived, if any of the German diplomats came, Tony would make snowballs with stones in them. But nothing very dramatic happened. It was quite difficult, though, sort of having to cut dead people with whom one had known all one's life or even were related to.
What was the attitude of the Swiss population to the two sides?
On the whole, the German population was pro-Allied and the French population was pro-German. Very odd.
Seems strange.
Yes.
What was the explanation for it?
Fear, I suppose.
How did they treat you as British people in Switzerland during the war?
Oh, in general, very well. We were a large family and we knew a lot of people. And my mother was a very remarkable and saintly woman whom they were all very full of admiration. Our house was always full of people visiting. My father was a very amusing, witty man. So it was a lovely time, really, except that we were at war and we didn't quite know what was happening. But all the care of the prisoners of war, there was a great office at Bern for supplying things for the prisoners of war in camps in Germany. And we used to, my sister and I, used to fill little boxes with tooth powder for them. And also one collected tea leaves, which one put into bundles. There's a phone. And we had to bundle those up and send them in for the poor Indians in the prison camps. They missed tea so dreadfully. So we did little jobs like that.
Did any British prisoners of war escape from prisoner of war camp into Switzerland that you knew of?
If they did, I don't remember. There was quite a sort of a security element there. I suppose they must have, but from Alsace, which was German then, wasn't it?
Yes. Was